Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Whoa, a groovy intro. Yeah.
So this week on Dear Science, we have Marcus Jones. Thank you for being here today, Marcus. Let's start.
Thank you for having me. Welcome to your first day.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, a little bit trial by fire at the moment, but it's chill.
Let's start with the first story. Something about a giant tsunami?
Yeah, apparently. So we all know, or at least most of us, I think, know that the dinosaurs lived a few hundred million years ago, and they were killed by a big space rock that landed, it turns out, in Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula about 66 million years ago. And when it happened, it was pretty disastrous for anything that was living. So it sent up a blanket of dust and rocks and things that blotted out the sun for years. Temperatures plummeted and all the dinosaurs, or many of them, died. And this has apparently only been a theory since about the 1980s in terms of exactly where the space rock actually hit the planet. But when it landed, it would have generated a pretty massive tsunami. It landed in the ocean, and it would have sent a tidal wave up to maybe 1,500 meters. So it's nearly a mile high, crashing into the southern part of North America. And that was followed by other smaller waves after that. And it seems like we've found, or scientists have found, some evidence of that tsunami buried in sediments in what is now central Louisiana. So this is quite a long way inland. And so they were looking for this, and they were looking for buried structures using seismic imaging techniques to sort of see underground. And this is something that the oil industry do an awful lot, to look for oil and gas. And it involves basically banging in the ground with hammers and explosives to set off shock waves and then listen for what echoes and comes back. And about 10 years or so ago, a geophysicist in the University of Louisiana got a lot of this data from one of these oil companies about a lot of the seismic data, and it seems like they've found from this data that these ripples, or these sort of ripples caused by the tsunami, are still around under the ground.
Amazing.
Yeah, and they're about 16 meters tall, and they are, as you would expect, sort of they're perpendicular to the direction of, you know, if you trace it back, and it points back to where the space rock sort of landed. And it's, I mean, this is still a theory, but it seems to fit. And the waters in 60 million years ago were quite a bit higher, so it seems like the waters were deep enough that once the tsunami had finished going by, regular waves and storms and things didn't really disturb what was down there, so the sediment that had been shifted by the tsunami basically got fixed in place and is still there today.
Amazing. Yeah. And so just to go over, I'm not 100% sure whether you mentioned that, but how do they find where this happened? Like, how do you know that it happened in this particular place and that this might be what you'll find?
Well, it seems like there's a lot of oil and gas companies that are looking around for oil and gas.
Yeah,
and they are, that's right, and they're sort of looking everywhere, and they use these seismic methods to sort of figure out what's underground. And as sort of a geophysicist who's looking at this data can sort of glean some of this information out of the oil and gas studies.
Fascinating. Yeah. Well, should we move on to the next topic? Could you have a little bit of a chat about this landmark research that found questionable practices are surprisingly common?
Yeah, it seems like scientists are pretty untrustworthy.
Oh, no. Who are we meant to trust if we can't trust the scientists?
Yeah, so, you know, there's speaking as a scientist, there's studies that I've seen studies like this before, but there's a recent Dutch study on scientific integrity or research integrity that has found questionable research practices such as hiding flaws in research design or selectively citing literature And about more than half of the respondents to this survey admitted to doing something like that. And about 1 in 12 admitted to committing a more serious form of research misconduct, such as the fabrication or falsification of results or data. And that's pretty high. So 50% have done something questionable, maybe not too serious, and about 10% or a bit less than that maybe have done something really quite serious in falsifying data or falsifying results. And this is this was a study done by the this is the Dutch National Survey on Research Integrity, which is the largest of its kind to date. And they tried to take special precautions because scientists are not going to admit to this unless they are anonymous. So they took special precautions to guarantee the anonymity of respondents. And they sent their invitations to about 60,000 researchers to take part in this. And they worked across all fields of research in science and also in the humanities at about 22 Dutch universities. Many of the institutions refused to cooperate because they feared the negative publicity. And so only about 10% of those invited actually completed the surveys. But that's still more than any other previous survey. And the response rate at the participating universities was in line with about 20%, in line with previous surveys. And so they've published a couple of papers. One of the papers focuses on the misbehavior, cases of fraud, questionable research practices, and things like that. And another article focuses on the responsible behavior. So that includes correcting your own published errors or sharing data, pre-registering experiments, posting hypotheses and things like that are good research practices. Mm. About 53% of the respondents admitted to frequently engaging in one of the 11 questionable research behaviors within the last 3 years. That was 53 of PhD students who were a little less trustworthy than the associate professors and professors, and that was only about 49%, so there's not much difference. We're all pretty untrustworthy. So there's reasons for this, I think. And one of the reasons is the pressure to publish. So scientists face this pressure. They want to advance their careers, they want to make a name for themselves, they need to publish their data, they need to get grants and things like that to survive. Means that they take shortcuts, or they sort of just tweak the data a little bit, it didn't really do it very much, and it doesn't really matter, and then they publish it, and it's misleading, and it's scientific fraud. But on the other side, let's say you exclude an outlier from your results, so you've got a data set and you exclude some of the outliers. Well, but sometimes that is justifiable. There's sometimes good reasons to do so. And also publishing negative results. So saying you propose a hypothesis and it doesn't come true, or your results don't show what you want them to show, publishing that is actually very hard because the journals not really interested in that. They want the big glossy stories and not the, oh, we tried it and it didn't work sort of stories. So it sort of points to the fact that we need to try and, the whole way we restructure research and academic research needs to be looked at carefully because, there are these pressures to commit fraud or falsify data, even if it's only a little bit. Mm. And there are ways to get around that. So good practices need to become more commonplace, posting raw data and publicizing your hypothesis before you do the study and things like that are good research practices, and they need to be pushed and encouraged by the institutions for which these people work.
Do you think that because I suppose this information has come from a survey and people sort of fronting up and saying this is what I've done or I haven't done in the past, and I suppose a lot of published academic work is peer reviewed or is like looked at by other people and is checked in. How do sort of problems with people's data sets or whatever get through the cracks when it comes to peer reviewing as well?
Well, peer reviewing can be quite an arduous process. Mm.
I can imagine.
If you're going to look really in sort of intricate detail into a published piece of work, it takes a long time. Mm. And if it's your friend or your mate down the hallway who's published this paper and you're the peer reviewer and you just sort of glance at the paper and it seems to look okay, there's a lot of that goes on, I think. There's sort of questionable commitment to quality peer reviewing. So that's another element of this sort of
change is necessary.
Misconduct,
And so finally, a quarter dose of the Moderna vaccine still gives a big immune response. That's pretty amazing.
Apparently, and this is tremendous news because there is a shortage, an acute vaccine shortage in some places in the world, especially in, you know, southern places globally. It seems that a little bit of coronavirus vaccine actually goes a long way towards generating some sort of lasting immunity. And recent studies found that two jabs that each contain only about a quarter of the standard dose of the Moderna COVID-19 vaccine gave rise to long-lasting protective antibodies and virus-fighting T cells in a study that included about three dozen people. And so this hints at the possibility of administrating a fractional dose or a quarter of the dose or something like that to stretch the limited supplies in some parts of the world and accelerate the global immunization effort. And this is already being done in some parts of Africa and South America against diseases like yellow fever, but it hasn't been tried yet with COVID-19. Mm. So in the earliest trial, so this is done with a Moderna vaccine, which I think is very similar to the Pfizer vaccine that we're getting in New Zealand mostly. And in the earliest trials of that Moderna vaccine, the study participants received one of three dose levels. So there were 25, 100, and 250 micrograms of the vaccine. The top dose apparently proved too toxic and was too much. The low dose elicited the weakest immune response, but the middle dose seemed to offer the best balance, like the Goldilocks dose.
And then
was the 100 microgram dose became the one that was authorized. But the Moderna scientists later showed that half of that dose seemed just as good as the standard dose. And it seems like an even lower dose when people were given, in this trial, were given a 25 microgram jab of the vaccine 28 days apart. Nearly all of the participants had the neutralizing antibodies that blocked the virus from infecting cells 6 months after the two jabs.
Wow.
Which is a tremendous thing because it means that we can really stretch the vaccine,
the resources
as much as possible. And again, people are saying, well, it's not the full, you don't get maybe get all the benefits, but I think the more pragmatic are saying we shouldn't really wait, we should just go and vaccine. And now a half dose now is more useful to an unvaccinated person than a full dose a year from now, and definitely dose stretching is a way of promoting vaccine equality equity.
That's probably sort of nice to hear as well in terms of the vaccine still being looked at. It's not just being sort of approved and then handing out to people. They're still researching it, which I think must be good news and interesting for people as well. It's exciting. It is amazing with vaccine shortages obviously being a very pertinent problem.
And in an ideal world, we wouldn't have these vaccine shortages. But, you know, we've
it is what it is.
It is what it is, yeah.
Wow.
Thank you so much, Marcus.
You're very welcome.
See you in a couple of weeks. Have a lovely day.
You too.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.